Welcome to another live edition of The Face of Pro-Life. Today I'm speaking with John Martin. Thank you for joining me today, John. John is an educator in the New London Public School System. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your education and what you've been doing for the last several years?
Well, I'm a graduate of University of Connecticut School of Education, the Deak School of Education, and I've been teaching in New London for 10 years now. Before that, I had internships, student teaching experiences, substitute teaching experiences here in Willimantic, in East Hartford, Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, and now New London. For the past 10 years, I've been in New London as a history teacher, teaching at both the middle school and the high school levels.
So you've had kids ranging from 12 years old to 18?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about the environment in the school systems. In your experience, do the school systems foster a culture of life, or do they really foster a culture of death?
Well, it's, you know, John Dewey, who is called the father of modern education, was one of the 34 signers of the Humanist Manifesto in 1933. Public schools have had a long and checkered career of inculcating a humanist agenda in our schools and trying to remove not just God but the concepts and the precepts that come along with religion and religious thinking in public education. They want to strip all of that out.
For what purpose?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. But we consistently see this happening again and again and again. In the past 20 years, there's been dozens of cases ranging from students being able to pray before basketball games or football games in Texas, a student mentioning that Jesus helped move her through her high school career. I've had difficulty getting information from organizations, pregnancy care organizations in the school nurse's office.
Hmm. So do you really see a curtailment of the right to free speech in the schools with regard to students?
Absolutely. One of the big issues is that a lot of schools have embraced this concept of the Establishment Clause, this clear separation between church and state. And the Supreme Courts, the very activist Supreme Courts over the past 30 years, have been all over this idea of this clear delineation between church and state. And in doing so, they've aggressively rooted out anything, any freedom of expression, if it's religious-based or has moral basis, that has religious tones to it.
So I can see, one of our biggest complaints, we often say that, people have forgotten that you need to live your faith all the time. But if they're truly prevented from living their faith in high school or grade school and on up, you can see where, people can get that disconnect. So could you give us some more examples of, how students are curtailed from living their faith in school?
As simple as I was in a school where in a homeroom there are several students who wanted to begin the day with a Bible reading and a prayer circle. And I had no idea what a controversy this would entail.
This would just be voluntary. Whoever wanted to could.
This was absolutely, the students, there are two students who really felt strongly about this, and there are several of their friends who wanted to join in. I actually checked with my principal. He said that was fine as long as I had nothing to do with it, because he was wary of the charge later on that, I'm the one who's fostering this, I'm the one who's promoting this.
So you couldn't participate if you wanted to?
No. And I understand where he's coming from, to be honest with you, because we did have problems with some parents. And we actually had to, some kids ended up moving to another home room, and the long and short of it is that this administrator did put himself out by arranging for this to happen, by accommodating the students who wanted the prayer, which, by the way, is constitutionally protected.
Mm-hmm.
Tinker versus Des Moines was a Supreme Court case where a number of Quaker students were protesting the Vietnam War by wearing armbands. The school administration required them to remove them, and they refused, and they were suspended. they ended up graduating in another school district, but the course ended up, the case ended up wending its way through the courts, and the Supreme Court, you know, judged that students do not check all of their rights out at the door,
right,
and that they do have the right to freedom of expression. Unfortunately, a lot of the school systems today, and public education in general, bully and browbeat this because they don't want any sort of mention of God or religion in the schools.
Wow. So I see you have a nice cross that you're wearing. Would you be able to wear that at school?
I have.
You have?
I have. And there's been a couple of occasions where I've had somebody say, well, that's not appropriate. And I said, well, remove what you're wearing. You know, and actually it was peculiar because one person who told me to remove the, you know, what I was wearing was inappropriate was openly displaying her Star of David.
Wow.
And I said, well, you're wearing a religious icon. She says, no, this is cultural for me. And I said, but it's a religious symbol. And it is an expression of my beliefs, my background.
Yeah.
So every once in a while I'll wear it. And of course the kids say nothing.
Yeah.
Another instance I had is in the teacher's lunchroom, which is separate from the kids' room by actually a door. So there's no way that any children would be able to see what's going on. I say grace before every meal. So I bow my head and I say grace, and this teacher walks by and she says, what are you doing? I said, well,
like it's any of our business.
I said, I'm saying grace before I eat lunch. Would you like to join me? I mean, I only get 20 minutes for lunch and I have to look at this. I said, well, no, you don't. You can just keep walking by.
Wow.
To give you a counterpoint to this, I did a summer program one year, and part of the summer program was lunch. And I had a college student who was my intern, and once again, I'm saying grace, and she says, are you saying grace? I said, yes. She said, can I join you? I said, of course. Kids are walking by, and they're saying, mister, what are you doing? I said, well, I say grace before a meal. What's grace?
Wow.
I said, that's where you thank God for the meal you're about to have. And the blessings he's given you today. Can we join you? So within 2 weeks, I had three tables pushed together, and all the kids are sitting there waiting for me to show up with lunch, and we'd all bow our heads.
Wow.
and quietly just bow our heads and say grace. I didn't pray out loud. We didn't do anything, but these kids want that.
I think most people do, and that's what I don't understand is why people are so radically, you know, against any expression of faith in your public life, especially in the school systems. I mean, it doesn't go the other way. You know, I mean, certainly there are expressions of things that we would be totally offended by allowed in the schools. So why does it only go one way?
And I don't know. I mean, schools are supposedly these institutions of toleration. Many schools have, gay and lesbian student groups, and I'm all for that. I have absolutely no problem with that because I'm a tolerant person. But by the same token, if the kids wanted to have a Bible study club, I wonder how many public schools would sit there and say that's acceptable. The toleration seems to dry up very quickly when it comes to issues of faith, and I'll argue that there's a few reasons why. One of the reasons is, once again, I mean, some of the founding fathers of modern public education, like John Dewey, were staunch humanists. They believed that the public educational system, if I may quote, education is thus a most powerful ally of humanism, and every American school is a school of humanism. What can a theistic Sunday school meeting for an hour once a week and teaching only a fraction of the children due to stem the tide of a five-day program of humanistic teaching? This is from Charles Potter, who wrote an essay called Humanism, a New Religion, in 1930.
So what is humanism? Could you explain that to us who don't know?
Humanism is a belief system that says that the only real glory is the glory of the human being. You see some of the fruits of this and some of the beginnings of this. I mean, as far back as ancient Greece, where the Greeks extolled the virtues, arete, being the best that a human being can be. In the Renaissance, we see another real big boost in this idea of a humanist perspective, and a lot of people will argue this is when humanism was born. modern day humanism is that we don't need, you know, some musty old deity standing over us and casting judgment and, you know, and commandments, and we don't need that. Man is a creature in and of himself, and we should revel in that, we should celebrate that, and we should promote that.
Mm-hmm. It's really so true, the quote that you said, and we've often complained about this, you know, those of us who have had kids in public school, you know, you try so hard to raise your kids in the faith, whatever faith it may be, and, you know, whether you go to Sunday school if you're Protestant or CCD if you're Catholic, they only get an hour, you know, outside of that mm-hmm. situation. And I know just little instances that you could see, you know, even as in the really young grades, of things being chipped away. Like, I remember teaching the children about St. Patrick's Day was coming up, and so I told them about the Trinity and using mm-hmm. the shamrock, you know, to illustrate that, and that's how St. Patrick illustrated the Trinity to the Irish. And so the kids bought it. They understood it. Well, they come back the next week after going back
Excuse
to the
me,
public
I'm sorry.
School, and they ask me, well, you know, what do leprechauns and rainbows have to do with St. Patrick? So, well, really nothing. Let's go back to what it really means. So, I mean, just little things like that where they're not going to talk about the true meaning of these celebrations or these holidays, but they will, you know, foster, you know, these, you know, commercial, you know, type celebrations.
And it's a variable that they can't control. Faith is a variable that they cannot control, and to a lot of people in education. I mean, even a lot of the teachers are products of the 1960s and 1970s, where we see a huge shift from a lot of bedrock values, and this whole idea of toleration for everything except, you know, unfortunately, religion. And some school districts do it better than others. I've been in school districts where, for example, the Muslim students are provided a room where they can go and pray because they're called to pray five times mm-hmm. a day. I've seen accommodations like that in some schools, and my hat's off to them. It's you know it, but the idea of Catholicism really seems to be something that a lot of teachers and administrators are threatened by. And some of it, I think, has to do with the fact of the National Education Association, and of which I'm forced to be a member of. But
why is that? I mean, are they upset by Catholics because Catholic schools are, you know, notoriously, better at educating children with fewer dollars? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think it actually is something a lot more insidious. The National Education Association and Planned Parenthood and NARAL, which is it's a pro-abortion group, have very, very strong ties.
Why?
I have no idea. In joking, I was talking about it with one of my colleagues, and I said, I have no idea why the NEA supports organizations that are eliminating our future customers.
Yeah, yeah.
And people looked at me, and some of them laughed, some of them looked at me with disgust, and some of them told me I didn't know what I was talking about. And
it's so true, though. I mean, look at how many schools have to close, and there's less and less children, and it's crazy.
And one of the problems, I think, in public education is, unlike in parochial schools as private schools, have the opportunity to sit there and say, well, we're not going to accept you. You know, so you can be expelled for behaviors that we have to tolerate in public education, and because legally there's no place else to put children mm-hmm. when they can't be educated. But we don't provide a lot of these children who don't get a moral compass at home. We have an opportunity to provide it in the classroom, and we do have teachers who do. And you know, I might not be able to go out there and actively promote these things, but I think that, you know, people of faith who are in public education, you know, are called to kind of be silent witnesses
mm-hmm.
and by our deeds and by our actions try to promote, you know, behaviors that are moral in nature. But as an institution, I have no idea why education is laying in bed with groups like Planned Parenthood and NARAL.
It's interesting, you know, that you say that, because I know that people in the past, teachers, educators in the past, have tried to, you know, quote unquote, buck the system, because they have been upset when they found out that their union dues and are supporting, you know, pro-abortion candidates or like you said, are in bed with Planned Parenthood or NARAL. And then more recently, in the state of Connecticut, with the Constitution Convention question, mm-hmm. The biggest opponent to the Constitution Convention question was the NEA, and they pumped in millions of dollars from the national organization to defeat the ballot question. But they also, at the same time, were pumping in, you know, millions of dollars into California to oppose Proposition H, mm-hmm. or H, which was the amendment to the California Constitution to ban gay marriage. So what is their interest in those types of things? You know, what is their interest in gay marriage? How does that promote education?
There are some issues of tolerance and things like that. And public education really was originally, or at least in the 20th century, to prepare children to grow up to be adults where they'd be able to hold down a job, they'd be able to pay taxes, they'd be able to participate in an American, you know, democratic republic, and they'd be productive citizens. And a lot of these issues, these social issues, were left back to the parents. Mm-hmm. And schools have done a pretty good job at hijacking a lot of these things. One example is a student who did a piece of artwork for a class where he drew a landscape where there was a burning cross in the background and John 3:16 over it. And the teacher said, "You've got a zero. I'm not accepting this." And, you know, the child, of course, fought it, and it's making its way through the court system now. And it has been decided that, you know, it was inappropriate for the teacher to deny that child credit. Oddly enough, two other pieces of artwork both showed demons, and those were accepted. It's the sculpting of student opinion, and then religion has just become the hot potato in public education. A lot of teachers look at people with faith as if we are unclean, and I don't understand that, because our founding fathers crafted the Constitution based on ideas of Christian thought and Christian morality.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like you say, if it is supposed to be a bastion of tolerance, you really should allow people to live their faith, and the students to live their faith in the schools, because they're never going to be productive citizens if they are learning one thing at home and then, you know, their parents are being undermined in the education system. So I don't see any good coming out of that type of undermining the parents' will.
It's a very real thing. Right now there are some cases rolling around where there's a parent who's objected to their child being subjected to a health curriculum that talks about homosexuality. The child's in third grade. The parent sits there and says, when it comes to talking about sexuality and these kind of
at
issues...
At all,
hetero or homosexual, I mean, you know, issues, that's my ballywhack as the parent. You know, health classes, I never remember any of that stuff in my health classes.
No.
And the public education system has been hijacked by liberal... excuse me, I'm terribly sorry. Has been hijacked by this liberal, secular... agenda, and they've done a wonderful job at it. Don't forget, Bill Ayers, one of the members of the Weather Underground, who was responsible for bombing people's homes, police stations, post offices, you know, an organization that was responsible for taking human lives during the Vietnam War, right here in the United States, is a respected member of the School of Education in Chicago. You know, he's an educational leader.
Mm-hmm. He's training tomorrow's educators.
And that's where we see a lot of these things. I have no idea why schools of education have become... Well, I do have an idea why, because of guys like John Dewey. and because of this influence of trying to take the United States and making it a less Christian nation. One, some people will argue, and I'm actually thinking it's not such a bad argument, that some of it has to deal with the rise of socialism. And, you know, in communism in the 50s was a hotbed. You know, the United States was in the middle. It was a key battleground for a communist movement. Mm-hmm. And though the McCarthy trials went much too far, I don't think anybody would deny that there are some of these issues that started rearing its head and really becoming a big issue in the 1950s. And what's the first goal of social change, of socialism, is to kill God.
Because you need to be dependent on the state rather than God.
You want to replace this idea, and I think public education is trying to supplant family values for some sort of. I'm terribly sorry. I have a cold.
Yeah, our producers will be putting up the phone number, and in a few minutes, we'd love to take your calls if you have any questions for John. And I have another question I wanted to ask. So, when did this all start? Did this start in the early 60s, or when did this start?
There are several main cases. Once again, I'm going to be consulting with my notes so I don't mislead anybody. But in the 1960s, you began to see a spate of cases coming out. Most of them having to do with, the first big one that came out was in 1962. The New York Board of Regents, which is the organization that maintains all the public schools in New York, had created a non-denominational prayer which read, "Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee, and we beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country." Well, in 1962, in Engel versus Vitale, it hits the Supreme Court. And Justice Hugo Black, who wrote for the majority, said it's no part of the business of governments to compose official prayers. And that was the first real blow in public schools. It's interesting that there was one of the dissenting, Justice Stewart, and once again I want to make sure I get his quote correctly, was passionately against this decision. And he would argue that the Supreme Court making this decision was, it led not to true neutrality with respect to religion, but to the establishment of a religion of secularism in the United States. This was very closely followed by school prayer in the next year, in another case, Murray versus Curlett, and this was Madeline Murray O'Hare leading this crusade to abolish school prayer. Several other
one
cases.
One person.
And this was against the school board of Baltimore. On the local level, the judge who dismissed this petition says it's abundantly clear that the petitioner's real objective is to drive every concept of religion out of the public school system.
Now, back then, children actually read the Bible in school as part of literature.
And Benjamin Rush actually, who's one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, to quote another person, "The only foundation for a useful education in a republic is to be aid in religion. Without this, there can be no virtue, and without virtue, there can be no liberty. And liberty is the object and life of all republican governments. Without religion, I believe learning does real mischief to the morals and principles of mankind." To help illustrate that point, in 1940, teachers most complained of students talking out of turn, chewing gum in class, making noise, running in the hallways, cutting in line, violating dress codes, and littering.
And you can imagine what the violation of dress codes would have been back in the 40s.
It's probably you didn't have your tie or your shirt was untucked. In our modern day school system, and unfortunately after 15 years of public education, I think I've seen all of these things happen, well, not at first hand. Drug abuse, alcohol abuse, pregnancy, suicide, rape, robbery, and assault. And once again, in 15 years, I've seen students who have been directly impacted by all of these things.
No, I mean, it doesn't really take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you take God out of school, you take that one incentive for kids to behave themselves, whether the teacher's in the room or not. You know what I mean? If you teach children that, you know, they're never alone, that God's always with you, you know, in good and bad, you know, it does help them to keep a good moral compass, because, you know, but if you take that away, you know, it just, you can see how it erodes their behavior.
It's every one of these cases came about as this concept of separation in church and state. And
which is not really in the Constitution.
No, it's the Establishment Clause clearly states that the United States will not establish an official religion. Official religions was a problem plaguing the early republic. As a matter of fact, Connecticut until 1818, Congregationalism was the official religion of Connecticut, and everyone had to pay a tax to support the local congregation. Mm-hmm. The signers, the founders of the Constitution, our founding fathers, were very religious men. John Adams was one of the crafters of both, you know, he was involved in the Declaration of Independence, and he was also on the committee that drafted the Constitution, was passionate about religion. And all of these men were. George Washington, even Thomas Jefferson, who the secularists like to bring out as their poster boy.
Right.
Thomas Jefferson wrote extensively in a number of letters about the significance and the meaning of this Christian republic, this republic based on Christian values. Benjamin Rush was not alone. Roger Sherman, who was another Connecticut resident, who was involved in the Declaration, and I am so sorry, the Declaration and the Constitution, he was a minister. He was a professor of theology at Yale. These were religious men. On my website, there's an essay about the First Amendment, right? And there's also a rebuttal to Bill Maher, who talked about our founding fathers being cosmopolitan men who looked to humanism in Europe at the time, and he couldn't be more wrong.
Mm-mm.
The Establishment Clause was used, though, however, in cases like these three that I illustrated, to open this breach where, instead of the United States being, you know, instead of me being protected from the government's being protected from me,
yeah,
because
right.
of this.
I mean, clearly, the whole idea was that they didn't want Connecticut, as one of the states, to influence Washington to then make the whole United States Congregationalist. You know, it was a separation that the central government was not going to impose a specific religion on everybody. But clearly, in all of their documents, they refer to the Creator, or, you know, in God we trust. And so they clearly were a religious group of men and women, and they fought hard for the right to, you know, practice their faith. So it really irks me, I think, the most when people do everything they possibly can to prevent people from being able to practice their faith, especially in public.
And it's an interesting dilemma because, you know, as a public school teacher, I mean, I'm conservative politically, I'm conservative socially, so I'm very much the outcast among many of my colleagues in schools. There aren't too many of us who are conservative or who are openly religious, and the degree of intolerance that we receive is humbling.
What came first? Was it that people that go into the education system lack faith, or it's chiseled away as they're going through, you know, college and then once they get out into the working world?
I think that with many teachers, and I mean, I talk to a lot of teachers, and, you know, and it's just like we had an election where a large number of Catholics voted for, you know, the Democratic candidate. I mean, voted for Barack Obama. I think that there are an awful lot of people of faith who honestly, they've been inculcated that, no, you know, your religious life has to stay in your car. When you walk out of that parking lot, when you walk into that parking lot, you can't be a Catholic. You can't be a Baptist. You can't be a Muslim. You can't be a practicing Jew. You have to leave all of that at the door because, you know, well, I can't say heaven forbid because that would get you in trouble. But secularism forbid that you actually be a human being. I think a lot of teachers who are very faithful teachers on the people on the outside world, they somehow compartmentalize.
And I don't think that's not just true in education. I think it's true almost everywhere. And that kind of goes back to my complaint at the beginning, where if you're taught from the time you're in kindergarten that you don't live your faith in school, you can compartmentalize your life and your faith, and that's really kind of how we've gotten to today, where people just go to church and they think they're going to go to heaven, and it doesn't matter how they treat each other during the rest of the week. It doesn't matter whether they embezzle money from work or whether or not they treat people poorly, and you can see it everywhere you go that people aren't living their faith 24/7, and that's a mistake.
They are, though. I mean, there's another Supreme Court case that's winding its way through where there's a young lady who she was one of 10 or 15 valedictorians in her graduating class, and they're all allowed 30 seconds to make a brief statement. And she encouraged everyone in the audience to accept Jesus as their savior in their lives, which I think is a lovely sentiment for a bunch of young men and women about to go off into the world at graduation. She was refused her diploma until she wrote a formal letter retracting and apologizing for that statement. Their objection is, well, she didn't say that during the rehearsal, because they had a rehearsal and she said something else. Her argument was, well, this is what I felt called to do.
Yeah.
And this is the world we live in.
I know.
And this is a clear cut. I mean, I'm sorry, my students absolutely have the right to express their religious beliefs. My students have the right to read the Bible. My students have the right to pray, even openly. So there are children who are truly, these kids are conservative. They want this. They ask you questions. My rosary fell out of my pocket one day, and a girl sat there and said, "What is that anyways, mister?" And I explained what the rosary was, and she says, "That's really neat." And
the phone number, if you'd like to call and ask John a question, is 456-3000. That's 456-3000. I remember when you were talking about the girl who lost her diploma until she apologized. Mm-hmm. It's sad that that people of faith have to fight for their rights. I remember after the Columbine massacre, there were parents were asked to, I don't know, was it design a tile or something, as mm-hmm. for a memoriam for their children who were killed, and a few of the parents had incorporated a cross,
yep,
in their memorial, which, especially for the one girl who prayed to God as she was being shot, would be so appropriate, and they were denied that.
It's actually one of the, I think, if my memory serves, I mean, her cell phone was on her, or somehow she actually forgave the young man,
yeah,
as he was shooting her.
Yeah.
And I mean, why should that be suppressed? I mean, that child died as she was a martyr. She was a testament of the best in human. See, religion is the true extension of humanism. And, somehow I don't get it, because God set us apart. He made us different. I've talked to young people before, and one of the things I often tell these children, because sexual promiscuity is a horrible, horrible plague in our society, especially among the young. They're pulled in so many between the internet and what they see on television. They're pulled in so many of these directions. When I talk to young people, I was talking to a group of young ladies once, and I said, "Listen, ladies, in all of human creation, since the time God made the world till now, there's one of you. From this point onwards until the time of Judgment Day, when there is no more, the end of time, there will still only be one you. Isn't that worth something? Isn't that special?"
Mm-hmm.
I mean, shouldn't you be
precious? Yep.
I mean, shouldn't you celebrate what you are as something that is rare and unique and will never be seen again? And then I take it a step further and I say, I also believe that in this world, God has created somebody for you,
mm-hmm,
who has never existed before and will never exist again. And doesn't that person deserve somebody who has kept herself or himself special and pure? And the kids, oh, they want to hear these things.
Yeah.
And you don't have to throw condoms at them and say, I'm sorry, you're a 15-year-old kid. You know, if you're sitting there saying, no, it's okay. It's only natural to want to have sex. Go ahead and have it.
How far have we come? Because I know we never got any of this stuff in school. So how far have we come? I mean, they're not actually promoting promiscuity in school.
There's actually, there's a curriculum that thankfully seemed to have died down. Connecticut was actually entertaining in committee a plan where Planned Parenthood would actually be contracted to teach sexual education in our schools. And in school systems where they are involved in the schools and in health education, they use a book, I think it's called It's Only Normal or It's Only Natural, where they show, they have line drawings of prepubescent children touching themselves
and
exploring themselves and each other. And, I mean, if you're showing
this
to...
Same sex, opposite sex, yeah.
You're showing this to fifth grade children. I mean, they talk about... You know, pardon me, but they talk about masturbation and how it's okay.
Lord.
This is, and this is in the public schools.
I mean, it really has no place in the schools at all. I mean, I know my son's in sixth grade, and oh, I'm sorry, he's in seventh grade. And he is just, it would just be abuse, sexual abuse of a child to introduce all this information to him. It would be just such an overload. I just find it so appalling that adults would think it their right to usurp a parent's job and their rights to teach their children as they wish. It's scary.
There are some school districts that have opt-out programs. It's interesting because in my research I found there are several cases where there are school districts that tried to accommodate parents by bringing in religious education and as kind of like a special.
Oh, wow.
So it would be like an extracurricular activity almost where children would have that hour and they would go. And that was, of course, quickly.
I was going to say, that would be great.
That was quickly smashed. And this is where it's important. I mean, parents have children. And guys and girls, I mean, I'm not knocking public education. There is no other country in the world that provides every child from the age of preschool to 18 an education that is free. We just need to fix it.
Right. We have a question from, or a caller, Catherine from Willimantic. Hello, Catherine.
Hi. I teach in the CCD program in my church, and one of the things I've noticed is that parents and school teachers need to be educated on the rights of the students. Because these students are, you know, they'll go in there and they'll bless themselves for lunch or something, and the teacher will say, you can't do that here, completely unaware of the fact that they have the right to do that. The teacher doesn't in front of them, but they have the right to do it. And then they continue to do it, and they get sent to the principal's office, who doesn't know the law that well. I mean, the parents need to be educated, too, so they can call up and say, hey, they have a right to do this.
Wow.
You're absolutely right, Catherine. I mean, more than once I've corrected colleagues.
Yeah.
Over that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you hear it all the time, children, as Corinne was saying, these kids are coming back from, you know, CCD and, you know, well, where's the leprechauns?
Yeah.
Have the rosary in their pocket and they keep it in the pocket during the class. But when they're at recess, they might take their rosary out and then they get chastised and the rosary's taken from them.
Wow.
See, I mean, this is once again where the parents, and I encourage you and the other CCD teachers, if you have parent meetings, you should be sharing with the parents, this is the Catholic Bill of Rights.
Right.
This is what, you know, this is the moral Bill of Rights. There are some things that church, that schools can and cannot do. Once again, in my research, there was something that, I'll be posting up on my website when I have an opportunity to put these notes together. But there was several things that schools cannot interfere, and parents should be receiving this information.
That's a really good a call, because I know when my son was in second grade, several of his classmates were preparing for the Sacrament of Reconciliation, and the day before, I guess they were in a free time, and one of the kids happened to mention to one of the other children, and they said, are you nervous about reconciliation? And the teacher, really lit into the kid and yelled at him and said, you shouldn't be talking about that in school. And it really upset my son.
Well, it should.
He was very respectful of the teacher, and when I approached the teacher afterward about that, she lied to me. So he was very upset then. So
but teachers are not getting the right information either on what they can and cannot allow.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that schools don't. I never had a course.
No, they just closed the door on it.
Child's rights. But in 1995, President Clinton directed Richard Riley, who was the Secretary of Education, to create and in 1998 update the ground rules for religious expression in public schools. And there are several bulleted items that, once again, I will post on the website. You might want to actually print these out. And when you have your parent meeting, sit there and say, hey, parents, they can't interfere with your child. If your child wants to engage in individual or group prayer or religious discussions during the school day, that's protected. Teachers and administrators are prohibited from encouraging or discouraging religious activities. And unfortunately, once again, in the example I gave at the Bible study, I'm also unfortunately prohibited from participating if my students wanted to do that Bible study during a homeroom or something like that. Well, some of the gray areas is what's going to happen to me if I ever have a group of students who come up and say, Mister, can we do a Bible study
after school?
I'm most likely going to say, well, geez, I guess we're going to have to meet at the public library or something.
My understanding now of the law is that if they have other clubs that they're giving rooms to meet, then they must give a Bible club room to meet, too.
Oh, that's actually, thank you for that piece of education, because I'm always one to swing when it comes to what I believe in. It's I don't agree with tenure, but I'm using it.
It's good for the right people. But yeah, it's a real big issue. And put that on your website, and I will print it out, and I will give it to my students' parents.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much for that wonderful call.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good thing to know, and that would be the best place for that forum is with the catechism teacher, or teachers giving this information to the students and to the parents, so that they do know the fine line they can walk in the schools, and that they can practice their faith. Maybe not you don't have to push it on anybody, but like you say grace before meals at home. You should be able to say grace before your meals at lunch. And these are the things, the tenets of our faith that we need to live all the time, as a constant reminder to ourselves that we need to live our faith all the time.
And there's nothing wrong with it. I'm fortunate in the fact that, I've always taught in schools where we've had a moment of silence. And adolescence being adolescence, after we do say the pledge, and I give my children a lot of credit, they do stand. Some of them don't say the pledge, but personally, I believe that all Americans, have the obligation, and non-Americans, because you're guests, have the obligation to at least stand for our Pledge of Allegiance. Then we follow a moment of silence, and I do use that time, and I do pray. Once again, in the hallways, a student asked me, Mister, what do you do during that moment of silence? I said, well, I pray. And what do you pray for? I said, I pray for you guys, that you have a good day. Well, thank you, Mister. and the kids do. And I'm lucky I teach in a town where, there's a lot of religious kids. New London has a lot of churches, and many of these kids do go to churches, whether Catholic or otherwise. But, so there are not as many problems. If I was teaching in other probably suburban school districts, I think I'd be running into a lot of problems, especially if I ever walked into school, wearing my St. Benedict medal. I'm sure that there'd be parents on the phone by third period yelling and screaming and wanting my head on a platter. It's, but once again, thank God for tenure.
With regard to I know in Connecticut, we don't have parental notification for abortions. Is that something that has, in your experience, touched the schools? I mean, have you seen instances where girls who are pregnant are taken by student or counselors or teachers to get an abortion or are referred to Planned Parenthood from school?
I've never had any definitive. I've never been able to see this at first hand or know of any specific accounts, but I've heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
I've had students talk to me about these issues. And during when I teach government, one of my requirements of my students is that every week we do current events. So, and one kid brought in something about the parental consent business last year or the year before. And so this started this whole discussion. And, you know, oh, I know a girl who did that. And, you know, there's a girl who did that. For those of you who aren't keen, you know, don't understand what parental consent law is your 12-year-old daughter can get pregnant, go to Planned Parenthood, get an abortion, and you will never know about it.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but even if she doesn't go herself, she can be taken there
mm-hmm.
by the predator who, you know, got her in that situation to begin with, and you'll never know about it.
It's Kansas, Illinois, or one of the heartland states.
Nebraska.
Nebraska, where a minor was taken by the guy who got her pregnant to another state.
Yeah.
And they had complications, and of course now the parents are very up in arms over this. I don't understand how you can, and this is once again one of the oddities of our system. We don't let these kids drive until they're 16, and then when we do, we limit their driving ability, you know, substantially. We don't let them drink until they're 21. They can't vote until they're 18. I mean, but they can make a decision about terminating a life.
Mm-hmm. And going under, you know, a drastic surgical procedure.
You know, without, I mean, you know, I've been hurt in school athletics and stuff like that. And, of course, I mean, they don't even touch you. They get you to the hospital,
yeah.
but they don't even touch you until
your
mom
parents.
Is called.
Yep.
I mean, that's just to do an X-ray, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea of, I mean, are there teachers and are there guidance counselors and are there school nurses who do this? Absolutely. You know, it's I've seen an awful lot of resistance to the idea of bringing groups that are pregnancy care centers and organizations that will, you know, help women keep their children
mm-hmm.
In education.
Now, you'd think that would be something that you'd want the, you know, the girls to be exposed to, that just the information that if you ever find yourself in this situation, here are some caring people who are willing to help you free of charge with your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of odd that you wouldn't be able to introduce those people into the school.
The establishment clause. I mean, organizations.
But they're not religious.
No, but, I mean, a lot of them, I mean, when you look at things like Catholic Charities, which funds a lot of these organizations, I mean, they'll take them when they need them, but, I mean, if it's contrary to, once again, you know, the National Education Association is in bed with NARAL and Planned Parenthood.
That I don't understand. We have another caller, Lori from Willimantic. Good evening, Lori.
The
Hello,
Catholic
Lori.
Faith is the one that is or under attack, or is it other religions also in the schools?
It's a great question, Lori. And it's interesting because in New Jersey, there were two girls who were Muslims and they followed, Sharia law, which requires women to be modest, and their headdress was a violation of the school dress code. And the ACLU actually got involved in defending their constitutional rights to wear their burqas. So I think that you do see Christianity under assault.
Yeah.
And I think Catholic. There's a book that I've been playing with for a very long time about Catholics in America, and Catholicism has never been a religion that has been accepted universally in America. John F. Kennedy, when he ran for office in Houston, actually renounced his faith.
Basically.
and said, I will not let my religious beliefs interfere in any way, shape, or form with my presidential duties. They'll be based on moral and civic virtues. Well, I mean, aren't those Catholic virtues?
Yeah.
You didn't see Joe Lieberman renouncing his faith when he ran for presidency.
Though he doesn't live it either, though.
No, he might not live it, but as a matter of fact, he even said, hey, I'm a Jew. I mean, this is I've been Jewish all this time. I've been in public life. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
But you know, Catholics, and a lot of it has to do with a lot of anti-Catholicism had to do with nativism in the United States in the 19th century. But as late as the 1930s and 1940s, you can see political cartoons Pope as this octopus with this Pope hat on, and you know, seizing civil liberties and this and that, and trying to consume Americans. There's a strong anti-Catholic movement that's always existed.
When you talked about the women wearing the burqas, I remember locally there was a young girl who, out of reverence for Mary, wanted to wear a bandana, you know, like a scarf around her head, as a symbol of humility, and she was prevented from doing so because it was against the school dress code. But nobody, you know, the ACLU did not come to her defense whatsoever. And I find that sad, you know. I mean, I believe that the Muslim girls have every right
Absolutely.
To dress, you know, their, you know, that they, out of reference, you know, to their religion. So I just find it, you know, just too strange that we will bend over backwards for Muslim faith, which is fine, but
Absolutely.
Why not, you know, Christians?
In the school that accommodated the Muslim students, one of the kids actually asked when he came back, well, why do you leave? And he said, Mister, can I explain? I said, by all means. I mean, this was a world history class in any event. So he was explaining the pillars of Islam and you know, how he's required to pray five times a day. And the kids were fascinated by this. There's nothing wrong with anybody expressing.
No. And you're fostering tolerance by allowing people to understand each other's faith. And that's what should be. You know, if we all lived our faith and tolerated each other, then that would be the idyllic world.
I'm often amused. I mean, the tolerant liberal humanists, the secular humanists, I mean, are the most intolerant breed of people out there. There's that case where that church was overrun by people protesting the Proposition 8, you know, running around disrupting a church service and, I mean, saying hateful and horrible things. But this is okay. This is free speech. This is acceptable. But the child wanting to wear, you know, the scarf or a child... I read of one where a child was actually wearing a T-shirt with Our Lady of Guadalupe on it and took some heat from a teacher. Many schools have dress codes which prohibit, you know, controversial or inappropriate slogans or designs. So, you know, and you see kids walking in the hallway. I've seen kids with Bob Marley T-shirts that have a big marijuana leaf on the back and, you know, you knucklehead, you know, you got two choices, turn the shirt inside out or go to the dean. And, and that's fine. I mean, I'm sorry, that has no place. Marijuana has no place. You know, the Bob Marley T-shirt has no place in the school. You know, there's a very popular period of time that, thank the Lord, has passed where you had cartoon characters carrying guns and kids would be coming in wearing these T-shirts. That time has passed. But the kid wearing the Guadalupe, you know, the Virgin of Guadalupe shirt and, you know, having a teacher offended by it, sorry.
Wow.
You know, sorry.
So do you see any hope? I know there's a lot of educators out there like you, like yourself, who do not really subscribe to the same values that apparently the NEA has. Is there any hope that you can... unleash that force that they have over the education system?
Well, I mean, as far as teachers, I'm looking into, there are some options. Connecticut is a closed shop for teachers, but there are some alternatives that where you can join other unions, and instead of giving my money to the NEA, I can give my money to something else. And I'm investigating those. And any interested teachers, I'll post that stuff on my website as well. But the most important, parents have forgotten that they give me their most precious thing and just leave them in my hands for 8 hours a day, and they don't seem to understand what's going on. Parents, you need to get involved. Parents need to understand their rights. The website is catholic-citizen.com, and it's important that parents understand that in just not in matters of faith, but in any matter dealing with their child's education, they have the right to go to the principal, they have the right to go to the superintendent, they have the right to go to the board, and parents, you have to fight.
Yeah. Apparently those opposed to any religious expression know these rights,
mm-hmm.
and are right there on the doorstep, making sure that their poor little Johnny or Susie aren't exposed to any, you know, offensive religious indoctrination. So obviously, we need to do the opposite, and that we make sure that our children understand their rights and understand that they can live their faith, and that, you know, obviously, they're not trying to impose their faith on anybody, but we need to, starting as children and as we work our way up through adulthood, need to learn how to live our faith in the world.
And children need to be comfortable going to their parents and talking about this.
Yeah.
Parents need to be comfortable advocating for their children. And 'cause parents don't do this. I live in the town I teach in, so I'm fortunate in the fact that I've seen my parents in church.
Mm-hmm.
I see them in the shopping mall. I see them in the grocery store. They know who I am. I mean, they've seen me wearing my Catholic shirts, and they know who I am. And they sit there, well, this isn't right, and this isn't right. I said, go and complain.
Yeah.
Please go and complain.
Squeaky wheel.
Because you're right, the secular parents, when I had those group of kids who wanted to read the Bible passage and talk about it, man, I mean, it wasn't even the end of the day. And parents, the phone was ringing off of the hook.
Wow.
So, people of faith, listen, public schools are a great place to educate your kids if you are involved in their education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have graduated some children who have done amazing things. So, it's broken. Let's fix it.
Yeah, and it really needs to start from the parents. And I know one of the things that, you know, because the incident with the reconciliation with my son was so drastic was because he never talked about school.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this was something that innately upset him. And he finally, you know, he was the one who brought it to my attention, and he knew that there was something wrong. So, you know, it was really important for me to follow up with that teacher, because he was reaching out to me and asking me, you know, why was this so? And if I hadn't, then, you know, he would have just figured out that, you know, he didn't have the right to live his faith in school. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. We hope that you've learned something. We hope that you talk to your family and friends about the things that you've learned. Go to www.catholic-citizen.com and learn more. And tell your family and friends about the website as well. And we hope when you look in the mirror the next time, you'll realize that yours too is the face of pro-life. Join us again next time.